Today, we are talking with Kate O'Neill. Kate is a highly engaging keynote speaker and strategy consultant. She is also the author of The Tech Humanist and the book Pixels in Place. Kate is known for helping clients prepare for an uncertainty at scale and in an increasingly tech-driven future. I am Zachary Alexander, host of the Subscription Maker podcast. Please hit the subscribe button wherever you get your podcast so that you won't miss any new episodes. The reason we invited Kate to join us today is because she talks about the value of creating a meaningful experience. And you can make the case that being of service is really about creating a meaningful experience. Kate, welcome to the Subscription Maker podcast.
Thanks, Zachary. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so, I mean, this just came up. I've got to ask, what's it like being a songwriter in Nashville?
So that was a funny part of my history, that I had always been writing songs since I was a kid, and it was always something I wanted to pursue here and there as a side business. And then it came to a point, it was in the early 2000s, that I had been working in the tech industry since the mid 90s, and it was a tough time, you know, after 9/11. After everybody remembers about 2001, that 9/11 happened, but few people remember that also that summer were like the WorldCom and Enron scandals, and there was a lot of mistrust, and people were just kind of cash flow conservative. So it was really hard to do a lot of consulting, and I just figured at that time it was as good a time as any to take a big risk. So I moved to Nashville. And I was writing songs and playing them out in songwriter nights at clubs. Like, that's a thing that happens every night. So I was doing that every night, working at HCA, Hospital Corporation of America, which is the biggest for-profit healthcare corporation in America. I was working there during the day, working on their next generation intranet. So still in tech, and then playing these songs every night.
So did you meet any famous people?
Yeah. So I had a lot of really interesting run-ins in Nashville over the years. So one of the quirks about Nashville, and it's more true in Nashville than it is, and I think in like New York or LA, that there's this kind of expected demeanor of the locals whenever you see someone who's famous, that you're not supposed to make a big deal about it. So it was not at all uncommon to run into, you know, like Jack White of the White Stripes at coffee shops. And he really expected people to just be cool around him. There was a time when Taylor Swift was dating someone who lived in town. So we would see, she was dating, what's his name? Shoot, I'm drawing a blank. The guy who played Spider-Man, I think. I don't remember, but whatever. She's dated
Tobey Maguire?
No, it wasn't. Actually, no, I must have conflated him with somebody else. Oh, Gyllenhaal, Jake Gyllenhaal. So he's not Spider-Man. And so Maggie Gyllenhaal was sitting next to me at a coffee shop. And then there was like meeting Bryan Adams, because he was facilitating, he was there to play at a wedding. And I don't know, it's just like one thing after another. We were at a fashion show, and my husband, who used to be in an 80s band in the New Jersey, New York, Philadelphia area, was talking to Tiffany, about big hair. Like, they had this funny conversation about how they used to get their hair so big. You just can't have that kind of interaction, like those kinds of interactions on the regular, like you could in Nashville. It's very down to earth that way.
Okay.
So it's fun.
Now that you allowed me to ask my question, could you tell us a little bit about your business?
Yeah. So my business has evolved out of 25 years working in and around tech in different capacities. So, you know, designing products and specifying them, you know, kind of being the business analyst who determines based on user requirements and business requirements, what needs to be built, what needs to be designed, and user experience, customer experience, so many different roles in and around tech. That what naturally grew out of that was this kind of overview that what I've really been doing all that time is overseeing the human experience and trying to figure out what's happening at that intersection between the business and the people outside of the business, and how to make the business successful without stepping all over the people that it's trying to serve, quote unquote, because, you know, not too many businesses really live that service mentality. but also how to make sure that people were getting what they need in a way that aligned with what the business was actually setting out to do and didn't take it too far afield from a focused strategy. So it's this kind of duality in the work, trying to be empathetic about both sides of that equation. And more what I realized was that tech was facilitating a lot of those interactions, and data was facilitating those interactions. So my specialty is really understanding that sort of three-part relationship between business, the people outside the business, and the tech and data that's facilitating those relationships, and how to make everybody kind of win-win in that scenario.
What kind of services do you offer?
So I had evolved in the last few years into primarily speaking about these topics and consulting here and there lightly around the subject, more advising, I guess you could say. But speaking was like 90-95% of my business. But obviously in the COVID pandemic era, there's a lot of disruption in the live events space, and speaking is a very changed animal. So that's primarily what I do still. It takes on different shape, and I'm very interested in seeing how we're going to ride this out as a speaking industry and a live events industry. But my mission remains the same. I still want to, help smooth over that relationship and understand the relationship between companies and customers, but in the human sense, right? Like the humans who work in the business. So thinking about employee experience and culture and things like that from that human-centric standpoint, as well as marketing and strategy from a human-centric standpoint. And more my work has steered me into thinking about the bigger issues of data and technology as they relate to society. So in terms of surveillance capitalism and data privacy and the issues of social justice that play out across, disparate policing and disparate surveillance issues. And so I'm getting to explore a lot of those discussions and topics in the new show I just started a few weeks ago called The Tech Humanist Show. So I'm doing that as a live broadcast every Thursday, and I'm getting to interview an expert from a different field or other. The first week I talked to Dr. Chris Gilliard, who's an expert in tech and race and privacy. And then the following week, last week, I talked to Dr. Raman Chowdhury, who's an expert in AI and ethics. So it's really been a great sort of exercise so far. I've got people booked who are experts in law and privacy, in emotions and data, and Sophia Noble, who is the author of Algorithms of Oppression. So really getting a chance to dig in and have some great conversations around that stuff.
It sounds like a bunch of big brains there.
Yeah, I'm really excited about how enthusiastically people have embraced this idea. And I've been able to get yeses from the folks I really wanted to have these conversations with. So yeah, I think we're going to be having some great high level, but also deep dive conversations around these topics.
Do you provide any subscription services?
So no, not currently. I don't in my business, but I've worked around subscriptions a lot. So one of my highest profile jobs in my career, I guess you could say, was I was one of the first 100 people at Netflix, and I was the content manager. So my focus was more on the display of content and the management of the back end of content, so the content database. But I really thought of it as a sort of customer experience, user experience type of role too, and that it would play out in how it related to subscriptions, the attraction of people to the subscription model and the retention of people in, the loyalty throughout the model. In fact, when I joined Netflix, it was just after, it was 1999, 2000, they had just introduced the subscription model of DVDs, just pre-streaming, obviously. So they had just introduced subscription for DVDs, and they had, not too many people remember or know this, that prior to subscription, they actually had an a la carte DVD rental program. So you could just like you would do at Blockbuster, right? Rent a DVD and it would be sent to you, and it had like a due date, you had to send it back. And then when they innovated this subscription model related to the DVD model, DVD business, that's when it was really clear to me that I wanted to join the company. And so I just sent over my resume and was like, I don't know what you need, but I want to work for your company. And they created this role for me. So I had a really great time there. And then years later, I was at magazines.com. So really thinking deeply again about subscriptions at a different level of abstraction, because we're thinking more as an aggregator of people's subscriptions and their relationship to the magazines that they subscribe to. And then, of course, I've worked in and consulted with a lot of subscription-oriented businesses, including a lot of startups as an advisor that used a subscription model. So it's a fun and interesting model, and I think it's one of the most sustainable models out there. And especially, you know, in industries where you could choose between doing something that was maybe more ad supported versus more subscription supported. I know certainly, you know, media and news and that sort of space has struggled around this because of the sort of commodification of content. But I think there's still a lot to be said about the value of building a subscription model around loyalty and the value that's being offered to people, as opposed to trying to incrementally sell ads or incrementally, you know, charge people by access or anything like that. Like, all of those have their flaws too. And I think there's something very clear about the value being exchanged in a subscription model.
How do you compete with larger organizations? You know, because there are a lot of strategy companies, there's a lot of tech advisors. How do you compete in that world?
You know, it's funny, I don't really find myself competing too often with larger, more established companies. Because what I do so often is speaking, and because I have carved out this sort of niche space around the intersection of tech and humanity, there aren't really other companies, larger companies, that I think could claim to have that expertise or that focus. So where it's the right solution, I'm the right solution. And that's pretty easy. So where I think it, you know, the opportunity breaks down a little bit is I am just one person. And so, you know, you have to think about capacity and scale. And so whenever I run up against ideas like, you know, do I offer any subscription services? Well, no, but that's a great idea. And I'd love to be able to figure out a product that I could create a subscription around. And, you know, maybe it's the show I just launched, maybe it's something else, but it takes the sort of capacity to be able to build those products out. So there's where I think the larger, more established companies do have an edge over a solopreneur, single shingle kind of person. But I believe that there's also trade-offs there, that I have the flexibility and the nimbleness to be able to update and innovate on the fly. And it's harder for a bigger company to do that.
Yeah, I think also you could say that your company is more personality driven because of your speaking. And that will allow you to grow, that could allow you to grow a community, grow a subscription business.
That's true. Personality driven is a plus and minus, right? Like there are reasons why that's a really good thing, and it's nice to be that clear about it. So I would say that, you know, one previous company that I started and ran was an agency called Meta Marketer. I launched it in 2009, had it till 2014. And we were doing analytics and strategy consulting services for pretty big companies. But I deliberately launched the company as Meta Marketer, like not as my name as a provider, because I wanted to build a brand that wasn't me, that wasn't just about me. And what I found during that time, it was actually easier for me to sell Meta Marketer. I could be more aggressive selling Meta Marketer because it didn't feel egotistical. It didn't feel like I was kind of building myself up to be so great or whatever.
Different, and that was conversation.
Yeah, exactly. So I had a lot of confidence that came from that. But ultimately it was hard to separate, you know, the personality from the business, and people still came to Meta Marketer because they knew me for one reason or another, because of my writing or because of my speaking. So I actually, one of the reasons why I closed Meta Marketer, exited it and started KO Insights was because I felt like I just wanted to be more clear about the fact that it is a personality driven business, and that there's no ambiguity about that. Like, if someone's coming to work with me, it's because they're coming to work with me. Excuse me, and that's something that I can approach with a less sort of pretense, that like, oh no, it's not me, it's Meta Marketer that you're going to be working with. So I think it just makes it clearer all the way around. So it's a good thing, and it has its complications, because yes, you do have to sell from a no BS standpoint. This is me you're talking to. I'm not I'm not one of a team of 50. I can't pretend that I am. All the language that solopreneurs use on their websites a lot of the time, that it's like, we, our team, you know, we're going to make sure that you, like, that's, we know that's BS. Just say, you know, Kate's going to do this, or I'm going to do this with you, or you'll work with me to whatever. So I think it's a funny pretense that we create this illusion of biggerness, right?
Have you ever had to pivot one of your businesses?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like what I've done more often than pivoting my businesses is pivot my own life and my professional focus. So, you know, I just gave an example of Meta Marketer that, you know, realizing at a certain point, one of the other realizations was realizing that the analytics and strategy work that we were such early leaders on in 2009 had become a lot more commonplace and commodified by 2014. And it was really tough to compete by then with, as you say, the larger companies, because what a lot of the larger clients that we were going after were already schooled about analytics, and they were already like, you know, we know we want to install Google Analytics, we just want to hire you to implement it in our site. I'm like, that's boring. I don't want to be just an implementer. I want to be the strategist that's getting the big brainy ideas and helping you solve problems. So that was it was a tough thing for me to see how we were going to overcome the maturity in the marketplace. So we tried packaging in a few different ways, but I felt like for me, the best solution was to get out of that business and to keep myself focused on where I really feel like I'm strongest, which is on the upfront strategy side and really solving more abstract problems, but in a way that kind of bring focus to the whole organization and alignment and a shared vocabulary and, you know, things like that, that really do help the organization function better and execute better. I just don't want to be the one there holding their hand through the long-term consulting project to make it happen. And I'm glad that there are people for whom that's a real strength. It's just not where I wanted to be. So yeah, so those pivots have usually been around recognizing either the market has changed in a way that I need to update my business's offerings to complement, or the market has evolved in a way that I need to, you know, either figure out a repackaging of our services or a refactoring of our teams, or just change. Just say like, okay, that's not the market that I want to be in anymore, and I want to get out, and I want to go step up over here into a more abstracted macro view of what's happening in that market. And that's happened generation after generation within technology in the last few decades, because the inevitably, you know, what used to be more of sort of a generalist role gets broken and splintered into different functions as those technologies evolve. If you've ever seen, for example, I don't know how many of your viewers follow the marketing technology canvas or landscape that a couple of different groups produce every year. But back in 2010 or 2011, if you ever saw those, it was like a breakdown of here's the analytics providers and here's the customer relationship management providers and, you know, all the different groupings. You could fit it on like a 1.8x8.5x11 sheet of paper printed out and still fairly well make out the logos on the diagram. But by this year, last year even, or even by 2016, it was so big that if you printed it out on two tabloid sheets of paper side by side, you were still going to have a hard time making out the logos. And that's just what happens. You know, the space gets more defined, it gets, you know, more nuanced, and people start getting down into the details of like, well, we provide this kind of CRM, not that kind of CRM. And if you need that kind of CRM, maybe you want to choose between this kind of complement to this kind of enterprise software. It gets so nuanced that at a certain point, what you need is people who know the whole space and can say, doesn't matter which of these you choose at some level, what you need to be thinking about is your end-to-end strategy and how you think about what the company exists to do, what the people outside of the business are trying to do, and how you fulfill that. And then there, you need advisors to help you with each of those pieces underneath. But my role has always been the best focused on that top level and really thinking end-to-end about that problem.
Who do you talk with about your pivots?
I would say, you know, it's a mix of people. I'm really lucky that I've been able to, part of it is I've worked in so many different companies over the years. And I've been an advisor to a lot of startups in some accelerators. And so I've been close to a lot of people who were also advisors and mentors in those same accelerators. So it's been kind of an informal network of fellow peer mentors. I have had few officially designated mentors or official masterminds that I've ever been a part of. I did belong to EO for a while, entrepreneur organization, and I have had people that were sort of my go-to. But I think personally, and this is reflective of who I am at as a whole, and I don't know if how many of listeners will relate to this, but it feels to me like being a generalist is really my specialist. And that what I do best is sort of pick and choose from a lot of different things. And so it wouldn't serve me very well to have one designated person that I go to. But for me, what's easier and better and provides me a more nuanced, meaningful understanding of things is to just sort of get a lot of information and then suss out what are the patterns. So I may have talked, every time I had to go through a pivot in my career, I may have talked with dozens of people, and maybe just informally on some levels, and sometimes maybe in more in depth. But I drew out of that what I needed, and put together the pieces that I needed over time. I'm sure that in your audience there may be people who see themselves more as specialists or focused, and that's great. We need those people too. But if you're a generalist out there, you're my people. That's where I am. I feel like I do not tire of learning things. I do not tire of surrounding myself with an abundance of information. I just constantly need there to be a fire hose of new knowledge and information being, thrust at me all the time. So that's, it's much more likely that when I talked about a pivot or needing to change in any business, that it's always been that approach. Just get what I need out of what I can out of everything. That's not a very specific answer. Sorry.
Yeah. Having said that, what's the best kind of advice you've received prior to your pivots?
It's a good question. I think one of the things that I have taken away from some of the other mentors who were, colleagues in those accelerators that has finally sunken in for me over these last, I'd say 8 years or so, is that focus feels like a sacrifice at some level. I think for many people, when like myself, when you're a generalist, when you're someone who loves kind of living in the abstract and the fire hose, that focus feels like you're sacrificing. But it's actually the most luxurious thing that you can do. Having a clear focus gives you the chance. For me, that's been this whole tech humanist positioning in the last few years. Having the ability to just whittle everything I do down to these two words, tech humanist, I feel like people don't necessarily know the breadth of what I do when I say those two words, but they know pretty clearly where I'm at, right? They have a pretty good starting point to understand where I'm coming from. And I think that's been super helpful because it's allowed me a lot of freedom and flexibility in the spaces adjacent to that to understand, what value do I provide in each of those spaces. So yeah, I think that's the one bit of feedback. I couldn't even say where exactly I picked it up from. I think it's something that a lot of people talk about. You talk about focus as being something that businesses need. But I think you need to hear it, like a lot of advice, I feel like you need to hear it in the words that are going to resonate with you specifically. And whenever I heard somebody say that particular framing, that focus feels like sacrifice, but it's actually luxury, they may not have said it in those words exactly, but that's how I remember it, is how I have retained it. And I feel like that's for anyone out there who's working on a business, that's a super important piece to however it's going to make sense in your brain to really let that sink in. That, the more you can be clear, not only with the market, but with yourself about what it is that you do and what problem you're solving in the world, I think the better chances that you're going to be able to create valuable offerings and create value in the world around that.
How do you know when to pivot a business versus when to start a new one?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the crux, right? I think I saw that happening with MetaMarketer where, you know, the market was shifting, and we pivoted a few times within MetaMarketer, even just in those 5 years that the business existed. I think if the market, if it looks like there's still a market fit and there's still, you know, a core of what the business is really set out to do and organized to be able to do, and it's a matter of just recalibrating, you know, the sort of the wording or the packaging or whatever of the offerings in such a way that they relate to the newly matured marketplace, then that's easy enough. Like that requires maybe, you know, a week of a few leaders within the organization kind of putting their heads together and figuring that out. But if the market changes so substantially that, you know, you're really not set up organizationally for an offering that suits the market anymore, then I think it's probably a point where a new business is an interesting idea to entertain. Like, I think you could potentially, I've seen turnarounds. I mean, I've worked in and around company turnarounds. But usually I think those have to do, well, I'll give you one example. Like magazines.com, when I was there, I was the head of customer experience and product development. And so a lot of what I was doing was kind of figuring out what people who were our subscribers or subscribers to the magazines that we managed for them, like what they needed from us. And what I was seeing and what all of us in the business were seeing is that magazine subscriptions were going up at that time, but subscriptions to print magazines were going down. So, you know, people were subscribing more and more to things like Wired Online or The Economist Online or things like that. And you would see that share going up. But we couldn't be too focused on print magazines, or we were always going to be in this dying market space. So we had to figure out some ways. And, you know, part of what I did when I tried to offer value there around was trying to create new opportunities around that. I don't necessarily feel like the company pivoted the way they could have. So, you know, that's getting into the specifics of that company. But I saw that opportunity, and I felt like there were chances that we had that we could have positioned ourselves better around online content and managing online subscriptions, because clearly that's where the interest was going. So I think that there are lessons there for people. Like if the market is changing because of externalities that, you know, the trend is obvious and you can't do anything about that trend, like people are just not going to subscribe to as many print magazines as they were before, or whatever the case is in your particular industry. Right now, COVID is forcing an awful lot of externalities to be real. Like people are just not going to go to live theater and live sports and live whatever. So, you know, these kinds of external factors are true and real, and we need to be very present with them. So my business of speaking and live events has been completely disrupted by COVID. And, you know, everybody's sort of pivoting to virtual and figuring that out. But there's also this very clear difference in the value that people perceive in live events versus virtual events. And so it's hard to, you know, create the same sense of like an ecosystem of value as you would with live events. So I think, you know, that's where there's not a clear answer there, but I hope that's some guidance that maybe some of the listeners can get some value out of. It's just thinking about the, you know, where the market is, what are the externalities? Are you really in a position to be able to continue to serve the people who need you in the way that they, in a relevant way to what they need? Or is the market shifting or the trend shifting in such a way that you should really be rethinking how you either package or distribute or reach or whatever the people who need you? Or do you just need to, you know, find a different outlet altogether for how to serve the need that you see? I hope that makes sense.
It makes absolute sense. Let's shift gears a little bit.
Yeah.
What's it like being a linguist?
So it's a funny term for me, because, you know, I have a lot of friends who are linguists in an academic sense. So they teach linguistics in university levels and so on, or they're practicing academic linguists. I am not. I was by education a linguist. My undergrad work was in German, Russian, and international studies, and then my grad work was in linguistics and language development. So I was super, you know, interested in comparative languages and kind of how they relate to how we communicate with one another, right? Like, so how do we get across the sort of package of content that I want to convey to you? Like, what words do I use, and what trade-offs am I making by using this word versus that word, and so on? Like, to me, that was fascinating. And to be able to see that play out across different languages and the trade-offs, the nuances that get represented at different levels in different languages was really interesting to me. So I have always been interested in languages. I studied as a kid, like studied French and Spanish on my own, and then got, you know, like I said, got into college and was doing German and Russian. Took French, Italian, and Spanish all at the same time in college and totally blew my mind a little bit. Like, those are really hard languages to keep separate from one another when you're just learning them. And now I actually study 14 languages at once on Duolingo. It just, to me, like, there's never enough. I want a lot of languages. But what that means to me is that you get to think about the ways that different people communicate. And I don't want there, because I guess I feel like part of what happens with my job, with my work, when it's under normal circumstances, is I get to travel a lot, even internationally. And I love the idea of being able to at least have pleasantries that you can exchange with someone in their language or something closer to their language that makes them feel like there's an authentic human experience happening there. Like, they feel like, wow, you really made an effort, you know, like you came to me. Here you are in India and you're saying, you know, some greetings and pleasantries in Hindi, as opposed to, you know, relying on this colonialist background that means that most people speak English there. And I think there's a lot of nuance in that even. You know, if you have shown that you are making a good faith effort at overcoming cultural barriers, then you're also saying, I recognize the humanness in you. I recognize, you know, you as a fellow human, and I want to make sure that we are equals. We're on some grounds that have some parity. So those are all part and parcel of what goes through my head when I think about languages. And I love language so much. And it's been so helpful to me in thinking about technology too, and about the ways we think about what meaning is created in online experiences and offline. Those things all blur together in my head. Meaning, experience, and data and technology, like, those are, they're very much in the same soup for me. So it's interesting that when I mention the language thing to people, sometimes they're like, but what? Like, you work in technology. Like, yeah, but doesn't that make sense, actually?
So how does that help you advise high-level decision makers?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that's funny about it is that there are the languages that we recognize as languages, right? Like English and Spanish and French and so on. But there are also the sort of dialects, or, I mean, they're not even officially dialects, but they're the quote unquote languages, like business language in a sense, right? Like there's corporate speak. Yeah, jargon is like what the language that like C-level decision makers use with each other, that's full of jargon, that's full of, you know, acronyms for, you know, various kinds of return on investment, or acronyms for, you know, different kinds of financial projections or whatever, that they're fluent in that. And so I feel like it's my job to be at least semi-fluent in that also, and in the language of other people that I work with. So I want to make sure when I'm in front of a user experience audience that I can speak to the main themes of user experience. When I'm in front of a product management audience, that I can speak to the main themes of product management. And I imagine other speakers do that too and try to use some of that language, but they may not be framing it in their minds as, you know, kind of speaking a language. And that's just part of how that framing works for me, is that I have this fascination with language and the ability to communicate across languages. So that's one of the ways that comes across for me. It definitely helps me to feel like I'm delivering strategic information in a relevant and valuable way to high-level decision makers when I can package it in their own language, so to speak.
What is a meaningful experience?
Yeah, so that, again, these things overlap so much in my head. So meaning infuses a lot of what I do and talk about. And it, to me, meaning is it's something that I've studied for a long, long time. And meaning is about, you know, you can think about all these different aspects of meaning that humans understand, relevance and significance and purpose and, you know, all of that. To all they mean is what matters. Like we're, when we talk about what is meaningful or what something means, what we're saying is here's what matters about that thing. So every time we talk about creating something that's meaningful, and I know that word gets used in such to such a level of abstraction that it feels meaningless, ironically, but when we talk about creating things that are meaningful, what we really mean is make something that matters. And so to me, when we talk about meaningful experiences, an experience I would characterize as being the intentional interactions and transactions that a company or entity is creating for its customers or users or guests or visitors or whatever the human role outside of that company or entity is. So the company or entity is designing these interactions or transactions. You can think of a museum even, and the visitors to that museum, they know that there's going to be the check-in desk and the ticketing. They know that there's going to be the entry into different exhibitions. They're going to have explanatory, you know, text on the wall for different things. Maybe they have audio, like headphones you can rent and listen to like virtual tours. So they know that there's all these different types of interactions that that customer or the visitors can have. And it's the intentional creation of those interactions and transactions in such a way that it reinforces what's valuable about the relationship. So in the case of that museum, in our example, the way I think about museums is that museums hold space for an idea. And the people who are visiting that museum are there to visit the space of that idea. And so all that museums get to do, so much of what museums get to do, is infuse the visit with more nuance about that idea and like really create a living space for that idea. And so I think even though museums may not be the business that, you know, your listeners are in, it's a parallel idea. Whatever your business exists to do, the people outside of that business are there because there's some value that they're getting from that, and you intentionally create the interactions and the transactions that they're going to have that amplify the value that's happening between the two of you. And so what meaningful experiences are really supposed to be is really understanding what matters in that transaction, in that interaction, and amplifying that, really turning that all the way up to 11 as much as you possibly can, making sure that, you know, you're playing to that alignment. You're really bringing out the value that's happening there.
What does it mean to create a meaningful experience at scale?
Well, you know, I use the at scale terminology when I talk about where data and technology come into play. So most of the emerging technologies that we talk about now, like AI and automation and Internet of Things and those sorts of things, they are mostly about bringing scale and capacity to experiences. So if you think about automation or intelligent automation, like primarily the idea is to anticipate a sequence of things and be able to do it more efficiently, faster, you know, with fewer breakdowns or obstacles. And what I anticipate happening is that as more and more of our human experiences are automated and put through this accelerator in technology, that we're going to have an environment around us that's built at scale for, you know, automated experiences. But I grow concerned that there's not enough meaning being sort of created in them, that when companies who are automating experiences create those experiences, that there's a huge opportunity and a need ethically to infuse them with as much meaning as we possibly can, you know, what matters, as much alignment, as much value as we possibly can, so that as those experiences begin to scale more and more, that we have a world built around us that feels like it represents human values and human meaning and things that we care about, things that matter.
When I think of at scale, I think of the situation where it's really easy to do something when it's small. So the fact that it's small can hide a lot of problems.
Yeah.
But as you scale,
yeah,
the things that you were doing that worked really when you were really small actually blow up and collapse under their own weight. So I guess the next question from that would be, how do you apply meaningful experiences to the decision-making process?
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a really important clarification, because I think we talk a lot about scale in entrepreneurship and in business strategy, and what we're usually thinking about is how to get something from being able to be done at X level to something that's being done at 5X level or 10X level. And what I think is really important to recognize there is that, you know, machines doing math with other machines is about as efficient as we're going to get. And that's what we're mostly moving toward in society, in this society, is, you know, kind of abstracting all of these interactions to algorithmic, you know, sort of rules-based logic, and they're being done more and more efficiently. Some of that is going to result in more convenience for us, absolutely. But some of that is going to strip away some of the nuance that makes experience delightful, and you know, that can make things like, you know, human encounters that have some serendipity to them, like someone at a grocery store or a bank or whatever, it's going to strip away a little bit of that, those human encounters and that nuance. And so what's important, I think, is to reinfuse some sense of meaning, human values, and human experience back into what we're creating in technology at scale. So that's where, like, you're absolutely right. Like, when you think about at scale, at a business operations level, it's that sense of, like, things that you can do at one-off are often, it's easier to conceal bad habits or, you know, things that you aren't doing quite right until you get to where you're doing them repeatedly and, you know, you're automating them. And now all of a sudden it doesn't make as much sense. But yeah, I think if you take that to its logical conclusion and you see that same process playing out across all different kinds of companies, across all different kinds of technologies, that's the big picture view I'm seeing with this whole thing, is that we are, as humans, we're increasingly surrounded by algorithmic decisions that are being made in every facet of our lives. And I think there's going to be some real cool, exciting things that come from that. And there are some huge, huge opportunities that we have to solve human problems at scale. But we also are going to be introducing an awful lot of weirdness into human interactions. So I think we need to be mindful and aware of both of those sides of the spectrum, and be doing what we can to maximize the good and play down the bad as much as we can.
I guess when I think of that concept, I think of Westworld, actually.
Yeah.
In the latest season, there was a situation where the EMTs pick up the main protagonist, and they pick her up, and they don't know how to fix her, because mm-hmm. the computer doesn't tell them. So they're just standing there going, "Well, hey, until we get some blood work, until our computer tells us how to do this, we don't do anything."
Yeah.
So it's like, well, you know, you got to give her blood if she's losing blood, but
right.
Computer doesn't tell us that, so that's my concern.
That we talked a little bit about that in the episode of the Tech Humanist Show with Dr. Raman Chowdhury last week, and she was talking about, you know, this kind of breakdown in a lot of AI and human relationship in the workplace, where there's going to be companies that enforce processes that say, you know, the human follows the recommendation from the machine, right? And there's, I think when we think about that, there's going to be an increasing need for good judgment making in the workplace. Like, when we think about the future of human work, one of the things that has occurred to me for years, as, you know, sort of projecting into the future, is this need for nuance and judgment calls. Like, being able to recognize when the machine is making a bad recommendation, a recommendation that doesn't play out with the context of reality, right? Or the things that you can see, like you're saying, like, this person needs blood, and I'm not going to wait for the machine to tell me that this person needs blood. And somebody could get fired for that in a lot of contexts, right? Like, not that exact situation, but those types of situations are playing out across, you know, Amazon warehouses and, you know, McDonald's kiosks or whatever, like all different kinds of businesses that are investing in increasingly automated infrastructure and decreasing the judgment calls that they rely on humans in those workplaces to make, which is more efficient and certainly reduces risk at some level of scale. But individually, when you take each individual decision that people have to make, if they see that there's an outcome that's inconsistent with what makes good sense, then it's a real shame that we don't have, you know, a better culture for being able to say, look, let the human decide in this situation. It's going to be something that I hope we learn with practice with this. And I'm glad that there are people like Dr. Raman Chowdhury who are having that conversation with people.
As we start to wrap up, is there a question you wish more people would ask you?
I don't know. That's a fun question. I think I love when people ask. I think the questions you've asked here have been wonderful. Like I love when people want to explore these areas of meaning and language and experience, and that they see the connectedness of those and they see the relationship that they have. So I wish more people would ask me about that, just like you did. But I think in general, I'm just glad that there's a threshold for this conversation. I just spoke at an event that Adobe had last week, and I talked about using human data to create better human experiences. And so I was talking about all these different kind of concepts. And one of the ways that I lead into the discussion is to talk about, you know, sort of in this literary tradition that we have about talking about the human condition, you know, what does that really mean? Like, what do we mean when we're talking about the human condition? And I think, you know, in general, what we mean is that humans can feel deeply and that we can learn and evolve in a complicated way. Like, it's not just reaction. It's not just you touch the hot stove, don't touch the hot stove anymore. But across patterns of learning, we can deduce from those experiences. And mostly that we are wired to think about meaning, that we're wired to think about these bigger picture questions. And so I just want to see more time being spent and more effort being spent at understanding those things that are human, that are really human, like meaning making, you know, like spending our time understanding what matters about things. So that as we create more tech products or any kind of products, subscription products, I hope that the folks in your audience are creating, you know, useful, meaningful, valuable offerings that people need, that people will benefit from. And it's all about asking those questions of what matters between what you're creating and what people who are receiving the product that you're creating, what's needed there and what's valued. That's where meaning lies. And so amplify that meaning. Make sure you're really playing that up. I'd love to see more people asking each other those kinds of questions.
What is the best way to keep in touch with you?
The best way to keep up with me is my website is koinsights.com. That's plural. So that's the best way to learn more, I guess, about my work and get in touch if you want to talk about any services. But the best way to keep up with me is probably on Twitter. So I'm Kate O, K-A-T-E-O on Twitter. I'm prolific there. So fair word of warning. But that's where I really spend my day, really interacting with people and cultivating relationships with folks who are thinking about, you know, the representation of tech in the media, who are thinking about, you know, how to consult with businesses about tech, about the relationship between tech and humanity. And then there's just a whole lot of goofiness and jokiness kind of happening throughout the day about these types of topics. So it's a fun space. So if you're at all interested in those conversations and you want to connect with me, please look for me there. And then all the other usual internet places, you can find me all over the place. Just be aware that there are a lot of Kate O'Neills out there, and I'm the real one.
Kate, thank you so much for joining us on this episode.
Thank you.
This is your host, Zachary Alexander, subscription service designer at thesubscriptionmaker.net. Please join us next time as we talk about what it takes to be a successful subscription maker.